This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Buy the book on BFM 89.9.
Hello and welcome to Buy the Book. This is Sharmila Ganesan together with, as always, my fellow MCO reader, Lee Chui Lin.
Hello.
I think we're all MCO readers in Malaysia at the moment, aren't we?
I mean, if you are reading and not spending an inordinate amount of time watching stuff, which I think a lot of people also are.
So I think, and that in itself actually sets up the topic that we decided to talk about today, this sort of weird, inverted, upside-down world that many of us are inhabiting, you know, not being able to go out of the house, being afraid of coming into contact with people, you know, a pandemic. So it naturally led us down the path of thinking about the whole width and breadth of dystopian novels that we've both read, and I'm sure many of you have, and just the idea of dystopia as a genre and why it's so popular.
Yeah, we apologize in advance. I mean, I know that there's not necessarily a real call right now for pessimism and darkness. Mm-hmm. That there is a mixture, I think, in terms of what people want. There are folks who want to kind of dive deeper into this feeling that we all have of being trapped or being worried, you know, this sense of anxiety. And that's very well expressed in dystopian books because they're really about the end point of all of it, right? This is what happens when things go very badly wrong. And then there are people who just want lightness and a little bit more comedy, a little bit more comic relief. This show is not that show. So I'm sorry in advance. We did think long and hard about whether or not to do this, but the time is right, you guys. I don't know when there has ever been another time in my lifetime that has felt so much like a dystopian book.
And I think that also brings up a thread, at least for me, in terms of why dystopian novels can be such good, absorbing and fascinating reads. And it's partly because there's something to be said about reading about people in really difficult circumstances and yet finding the humanity or the humanness within them. They don't always end well. So I don't want to say and finding out that humanity succeeds, because not every dystopian novel ends that way.
Nope.
However, I think there is a humanness and a core sense of questioning what it means to be us, which I love. And I think that lies at the center of many dystopian or most dystopian stories. And that I hope will carry through our conversation today and hopefully make it not as, depressing a listen as it might initially sound.
Yeah, that's fair. I also, what I like about dystopian books in particular tends to be that they are often very clever because they have to meld this mixture of recognizable and new. So it has to be a world that you recognize, and the things that went wrong with it have to stem from real fears. They have to stem from something that you can identify in your world today. You can see that there are totalitarian governments, that there are people who perhaps value certain things, value materialism, for example, more than human lives. You have to be able to identify these points, and there's usually a tipping point, right, where everything goes wrong. There's a great something, a great war, a great whatever, and after that things are never the same. So I find the very conceit of a dystopia quite clever in that it leverages on existing fears that you have about the world in which you live, and then makes those very real and tangible by subverting things that you recognize but you don't quite recognize anymore. So that, I think, is the little frills of dystopian books that I enjoy. And I think that we should say that some of our selections that we're going to get into are quite classic, but there are also a fair amount that we're not going to go down, even though they're hallmarks of the genre, right? And I'm thinking here of something like George Orwell's 1984.
Yes, I mean, 1984 is one of the first books that come to mind when we think of dystopia. And I think rightfully so, because it actually mirrors so much that is familiar. We've actually seen governments and more as digital technology becomes a place in our lives. The Big Brother effect is something we reference sometimes without even realizing we're referencing Orwell. So in a way, it's a conversation that's been had many times. And so maybe it's not something we need to get into here. And then also there are so many YA books that are dystopian in nature and some really, really good ones. We're not going to necessarily look at all of them. We are going to talk about one specific series that made a huge impact on pop culture. But other than that, you know, there are just so many examples of the genre that if you looked up, and I think they touch on every aspect of, you know, whether you like prom and you want a dystopian version of that, or whether you want family relations set in a dystopia, there are just so many options out there.
For sure. And lastly, we're not going to talk about Handmaid's Tale because we've spent a lot of our time talking about Handmaid's Tale as well as The Testaments. And I think that it's well-trodden ground here on By the Book at this point. So just to say very gently, we're going to sidestep all that. All right, Sharmila, do you want to start us off?
Yes, so I'm going to start with the mirror image of George Orwell's 1984, another book that's often brought up, which is Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. Mm. And I actually came to this book fairly recently, just about maybe 3 or 4 years ago, maybe. And I was really struck by all of those things that people say when they read books of this nature, that it sounds so prescient. How did he know that this was... and some of the things that kind of... strikes a chord with me is our reliance on the ordinary, our reliance on entertainment. In his book, it's couched as empty entertainment, and how that's almost used as a way to keep people suppressed. For those of you who don't know what Brave New World is about, it's set in a dystopian future where people are genetically engineered and they are basically born in labs, and then there's a caste system based on your genetic intelligence and capability. So there are people who are bred to be the smart ones, who are the upper class of the society, who are you know, well off, live lives of leisure and comfort. And then there are people who, because of their genetic traits, are bred to be the laborers, and they have traits bred into them to make them, what's the word, a submissive, I suppose, and not likely to, you know, so it's a fully engineered society. A key aspect of how they keep the society running is keeping them, one, occupied with meaningless entertainment, and two, by administering a widely taken drug called Soma, where everyone's basically just in this happy drug. So a lot of stuff about it to us definitely sounds very familiar. And so when I read it, I was just blown away by how smartly he crafted this world and the sort of psychology that goes with living in a world like this.
Yeah, there's a lot in there, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, listening to it, so I've not read Brave New World, but listening to that just made me think of Gattaca.
Oh, yes.
The movie.
Yeah,
not the book. But
I love Gattaca, but yeah.
Yes, and it has that kind of quality. And that's something that I think a lot of sci-fi and a lot of dystopian sci-fi in particular deals with, this idea that we're all sheep. Mm-hmm. It's the very basis of the Matrix, you know. Mm-hmm. But then this idea also that free will is nothing but a construct and it can be taken away at any time. So yeah, there were a lot of themes in there while you were talking. I was like, oh, that sounds mm-hmm. sounds about right. I'm going to touch very briefly on a book that I've brought up recently in the context of a book I finished, and that I think we talked about it in footnotes. I'm just going to bring it into the main body of the show now because I finished it, and that is Gary Steingart's Super Sad True Love Story. So Gary Steingart, I think in general, writes, I would describe it as dystopian satire. It veers into this very recognizable but very frightening world, and it's told in a very satirical, sarcastic, cynical, yet also sincere tone. He's Russian, so if that helps to explain why the tone, then yes. And as mentioned previously, this story is about a man who works for a company that is interested in immortality, but it's only interested in selling immortality in a very specific way to high net worth individuals. So in this near future New York, the world is being run by China, fundamentally. China has all the money. Everybody's currency is pegged to the yuan. And so the US dollar is, you know, depreciated to absolutely nothing if it's not pegged. And the real superpowers are in the East. So, for example, there is a whole sub-storyline because he falls in love with a Korean immigrant or a first-generation Korean immigrant. And there are moments of real regret from people who left Seoul, for example, which is now the superpower of the world, to come to America in an attempt to be a part of the American dream. And the world is run by, for example, Walmart, Amazon, whatever. You know, everybody's kind of glommed onto each other. Your value is very dependent on whether or not you have money, whether or not you have a lot of US dollar, yuan pegged US dollars. It's pegged to whether or not you are sexy. It's pegged to whether or not you are a source of entertainment. How much content are you constantly putting out there? And so through it all, you view America in a state of decline. It's fundamentally looking at America at a time where it is no longer a superpower and it's barely holding on to that. There are uprisings happening in Central Park, you know, and there are people who are camped out there trying to raise a stand because there are drones that come to kill all the low net worth individuals who are there. So fundamentally, what's scary about it, I think, firstly, it's very light in tone. It's comedic, it's gentle in some ways. In other ways, it's also about massacres and an America that, when you look at how America, for example, is dealing with the coronavirus, there are moments where you look at it and you think, this could happen. And I think that very real fear is what really drives the engine of the book. But also, at its heart, it is a super sad true love story. So there's a lot in there, but I enjoyed it tremendously.
So I love dystopias or even any speculative fiction that feels like it could be so close to us. And this, because of it, because of such familiarity, because of the places that they reference are still countries that we live in now, companies that sound familiar. I haven't read that one, but that definitely sounds like something I'd enjoy. So we do need to take a quick break, but so far our dystopian suggestions, should your reading loves lean that way, are Aldous Huxley's Brave New World and
Gary Steingart's super sad true love story.
So do tell us if this is the time to be reading dystopian novels for you, or would you prefer something else? You can tweet us at BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Or you can write us with your picks or suggestions at buythebook@bfm.my.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Buy the Book. I'm Sharmila, and with me as always is Lynn, and we are recording this remotely from our homes.
Yes.
And today we are kind of reflecting on that very situation, this rather unplanned for, you know, seemingly unlikely situation of all of us dealing with this global pandemic. And it reminded us of many of the dystopian novels that we've probably read. And we're just trying to do, a quick pick of some of our favorites and why we feel that those are good reads, whether particularly for this time or not, we're not sure. But you can let us know, you know, what are your reading tastes? Do you want something that feeds into what you're feeling right now? Do you want something to take you away completely? You can tweet us at BFM Radio, WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, or write to us at buythebook@bfm.my. And so Lynn, what's next on your lineup of dystopian reads?
Okay, so I'm going to talk about an author that, again, we have both talked about plenty of times. At the risk of sounding like a broken record, when we were talking about dystopia, I really did think of Stephen King. And that is because we've talked about him in a number of different contexts, I think, through the course of our show. Favorite writer, you know, in general. But then there's also stuff about how good he is at evoking childhood, how good he is, of course, at evoking horror, which is what he's best known for. But dystopia is something that really lives at the heart of a lot of Stephen King's best and perhaps best known works. I'm thinking here of his two magnum opi, opuses? What's the term? I don't know.
I like opi. I'm not sure if that is the word.
His two magnum opi, which are The Stand and The Dark Tower series, which are actually related to one another. I think if you're familiar with the idea of The Dark Tower, it's based very loosely on a Robert Browning poem and, you know, an epic about a gunslinger off to fight evil and try to reach the Dark Tower. That's the central thing. He doesn't know what lies there. He just knows he needs to get there and all the things that happen along the way. But I think between The Stand and The Dark Tower, you have a good example of how The Dark Tower is a fantasy book. And so the dystopia that it is set in is a fantasy dystopia. So it shows a kingdom or a dynasty in crumble. What happens after? What happens when everything is broken, when there are wastelands, when there are things like that? The Stand, on the other hand, is just, it's, how do you describe The Stand? It involves the devil, to put it simply. It involves the world as we know it ending and humanity taking a last stand in a time where a lot of the things that we take for granted, electricity, entertainment, anything involving that sort of creature, those sorts of creature comforts, they're all gone. And so I think that is very much, in both cases, he evokes the worlds in tremendous ways. I mean, they're very big books, but they're big books partly because they're multiple characters, partly because also the worlds are so richly described. And I think that that is a very key thing when it comes to dystopian books, that the worlds in which you are occupying need to be very, very identifiable. They need to be something that you go, I know this. I know what it would be like to not have running water. You're right. I would have to go and do that. And it is true that if there were a nuclear holocaust, that, you know, XYZ would be the fallout of that. So he's just a great world builder. And I don't think he gets enough credit for how adept he is at weaving horror into dystopia and weaving dystopia into horror.
So I think that's a great point that you make, because I think the reason Stephen King is so good at writing dystopia is because he knows the psychology of fear. He knows exactly what is terrifying. And that doesn't necessarily have to be a creature that's going to rip your guts out. It can be a scenario that you find yourself in that is just deeply fear-inducing. And I'm a fan of King, so it doesn't surprise me that you would think that he's a great dystopia writer. I must admit, I never would have thought of it that way, primarily because I generally just think of Stephen King novels as Stephen King novels.
Sure, yeah.
But you're right, that ability to write horror actually lends itself really well in being able to write about a world gone wrong. So on that note of evoking real life sentiments, as we were thinking about this show, one of the books that I initially thought I didn't want to bring up just because everyone talks about it a lot, but then I realized people talk about it in the context of the movie so much that they forget that the book on its own is a great read, and that's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick, one of the grandfathers of sci-fi. Again, more often thought of as a sci-fi writer than a dystopian writer, even though most of the worlds he writes about are very dystopian. And of course, the movie is Blade Runner. The thing that I realized about the book that the movie doesn't quite do, and maybe doesn't have to, there's a lot more world building in the book. The movie is a very focused story about the difference between that existential question of what is life or what it means to be human.
What is consciousness?
Right. Whereas the book has all of these elements that, for instance, a big part of the book, the driving factor for Deckard is wanting to purchase a real life animal, because they live in a world where real animals have been nearly wiped out. So they're incredibly rare. And only people who are really, really rich are able to afford a real animal, even if it's just a frog or a mouse. And so most people have robot animals as a marker of status, things like that. And people hook on to what they call empathy boxes as a way to feel other people's pain. So there's a lot of world building that goes on in Philip K. Dick's Electric Sheep, which I think is a real miss if you don't read it. Not because the movie isn't good, but I just think in terms of making you think about things that feel like a version of the reality you live in, but have just somehow taken a, you know, sharp, bad turn, I think it's a great book.
Okay. I feel really bad about recommending the next book that I'm going to recommend, because it is kind of a day ruiner, I think, for most people. But it is a great book. And so I'm just going to go with it. And that That is Cormac McCarthy's The Road. And look, for people who have read it and I'm evoking it, I'm really sorry. For people who have not read it, I'm not even sure I would recommend that you do if you're not in the right headspace, because it, like some other books, can be very emotionally fraught, I think. And of course, it was also made into a movie that was, I think, quite feted at the time. So I think that it might be a little more known for that. But The Road basically tells the story of a father and a son trying to survive in a post-apocalyptic world. Something terrible has happened, and now they can trust nobody but themselves. It is like many other stories that feature a child who is younger, not so close to adolescence, and a parent. There is a dissonance between what the father knows to be true, between what the father knows to have happened and what they need to do in order to survive, and his son, who is still looking at the world and thinking, well, why do we have to? Why can't we do that? And it is emotionally harrowing. Yes, that's the word I've been looking for. It's harrowing. It's difficult. It is very insular because it is just a story of two people until very late in the book when someone new is introduced. So yeah, it's fantastic because it shows you in micro form, I think, what can happen when a world is destroyed, how it affects a family. And similar to what we said earlier about Stephen King, I think the horror of dystopia is knowing that it cannot be escaped. This is just life now. This is how it is. Mm. And The Road captures the grind of that really, really well.
I will see The Road and I will raise it another book that I think is a very, very difficult read, but if you're in the mood for it, also an excellent one, Blindness by Jose Saramago. Only because in this time that we live in, it's about he's a Nobel Prize winning author, very, very good writer, but not an easy writer to read. He writes in terribly long sentences. But the story is about a pandemic of blindness that inflicts this city or country, I can't remember. However, it really reflects, I'm going to sort of place this warning right up here. In times like this, really make sure you're in the space to read a book like this. But it reflects so much of what humanity really would go through. Quarantine centers, the idea that people who are better off come out of this much better, the panic that they're not going to be enough resources for everyone. We are running out of time, so I won't get too much into it. But if you want a great, great literary novel that really reflects on the idea of a dystopia, when it comes to how humanity could descend, that Blindness by Jose Saramago is a great one.
This show has gone exactly as I thought it would. and I feel like I owe everyone an apology now. But I do know that there are a lot of people right now who are in the mood for that kind of read, who are not seeking out the lighter things, who
want catharsis. Yeah, there's so many lists online. I keep seeing people sharing lists of 15 dystopian novels, 15 pandemic books. And I mean, frankly, I'm not necessarily in the headspace for these, so I'm surprised. But I do think there's some amount of catharsis going on because I know friends who are doing Armageddon movie nights just because it makes them feel a little better.
Yes. And so this is our contribution to that conversation. If you are in the mood, these are, I think a pretty solid selection of dystopian books.
So if you are reading dystopian books, or if you're not, let us know why or why not. You can also send us your suggestions. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Or you can write to us at buythebook@bfm.my. Us to footnotes, and to take a bit of a break perhaps from the world of fiction, we have also been doing a lot of reading of articles, and really in this time there's been plenty of articles, nonfiction reads, long reads, whatever you want to call them, that's online, and so we each thought we'd pick one that maybe resonated with us quite a bit in the last couple of weeks and share them with you. Lynn, do you want to take it away?
Sure. Mine are not cheerful or even that they don't put forth, because I think there is a whole subsection now of long reads that are about how we're going to come out of this, or about finding hope and connection in these times. And I found those to be very, very affecting reads at the time that I read them. However, they didn't stay with me in the way that these two articles have. I'm just going to touch very briefly on one and then get into the one that I'm actually meaning to talk about. They're both on the New York Times. One is called Two Women Fell Sick from the Coronavirus, One Survived. And it was written by Sui Li Wei and Vivian Wang. And it's the story of two women in China in separate cities who fall ill. One is a nurse, one is a doctor. And it tracks their progress through the coronavirus, and it's all in the title. And I just bring that up because it ends on a gut punch. I burst into tears, and I didn't expect that. I was just reading it, and ever since then, every once in a while, I think about it. So that was a good one. Again, that's called Two Women Fell Sick from the Coronavirus, One Survived, on the New York Times. Also from the Times is an article titled What I Learned When My Husband Got Sick with Coronavirus, and it's written by Jessica Lustig, who is a deputy editor at New York Times Magazine. And she writes really beautifully and evocatively about her experience of feeling like she's in a time warp. Because as everybody around the world is starting to get worried, this was published on March 22nd, I think. So as everyone around the world is starting to recognize the severity of the situation, as everyone around the world starting to worry about healthcare, she feels like she's already been in that time and space, because she is, of course, living in the epicenter of the outbreak in the United States, New York, and she's caring for her husband at home because he's not serious enough yet to go to the hospital. But there are details in it, like how they have to sanitize the bathroom that he uses, because she's living there with her 16-year-old child who is now being spoken to like an equal, because they have to care in, they have to share in the caring of this person, her husband. And it's very detailed. It's very evocative. I found myself just thinking about them as a family. And again, it looks at what happens to a unit when something as big as a pandemic occurs.
That was, to me, a really compelling read. And it also made me think about something that I have been thinking about over the last couple of months, I suppose, you know, in terms of what we post on social media, what we talk about with people, what we share, because often I think we tend to forget that while, yes, there's a pandemic, it remains very faceless unless you know someone who has it. We post about our problems, and yes, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with saying being trapped or being devoid of human contact is difficult, and no doubt it is really difficult. But the impact of seeing something like that on people who are, like the writer of this article, you know, in the midst of caring for someone she loves, in the midst of this whole, and almost that anger slash irritation she feels when people are posting what to her seems fairly frivolous things, or talking about fairly frivolous things. Yeah, it really hit me how, without sounding, I think, too twee about it, that there are people going through much worse than us. Yes. But this does hammer that home in a very real way.
And actually, what you just brought up is related to your read, your article.
Yes. Yeah, no, so exactly. So, and I think that's kind of the headspace that I've been in. The article that made a lot of impact on me was this article by Nicholas Berger, I think his name is, and he writes it on Medium, and he is a theater artist and a writer, and the title of that is The Forgotten Art of Assembly, or Why Theater Makers Should Stop Making. And it's kind of a little counterintuitive, because we have also been talking about the impact of why people putting out this free content is so great and it inspires people. But to a certain extent, he also talks about the idea that a lot of the work that people are putting out is made out of a need to want to continue to seem relevant, a way to deal with their own fears, a way to assuage themselves rather than to bring any real value to the people who are watching. And he also says that there's almost something obscene in taking an art form that is so dependent on collective gathering, putting it online and expecting that then that isolation would, and it would still work in the same way. It's not something you necessarily have to agree with, but he brings up a lot of important points about things like intent, whether you're doing something for yourself or for other people, why arts makers think that work of subpar quality that wouldn't work on a real stage should work online. And finally, just maybe there's a time when this isn't important. Maybe a reading of an unstaged play isn't really what we need right now. And I think more important, he also talks about how we need to assess the whole broken system of the arts in general, and why they are unable to sustain themselves at a time like this. And so therefore, that maybe people should be devoting energy into criticizing that rather than just putting out content that at the end doesn't mean anything. So it's not something that you might necessarily agree with, but I think it brings up a lot of interesting points.
So I was most struck by the idea of having a pause, because I think as content creators, and we are also content creators in our own way, where we're not necessarily writing plays and putting them out there, but there is still an element of putting out content into a space that seems to require it, into a schedule that seems to require it. And I think the idea of a respectful pause and a pause that is respectful to your industry, the idea that, hey, maybe at this point in time, you're not what's needed, but in time to come, you may be more relevant than ever. So might be a good time to assess how that could be. I thought that that was very interesting. And that is exactly the kind of paradigm shift I hate. I'm so sorry, I hate the phrase, but that is exactly, I think, the kind of paradigm shift that a period like this almost requires or demands, because the whole point is that nothing is the same. The whole point is that everything has changed. So perhaps taking the pause to actually allow the situation to absorb and to think about it rather than reflexively just putting stuff out into the world is an important thing. And it doesn't extend just to theatre makers. I think it extends to a lot of different people.
Yeah.
And it also speaks to this idea that we're trying to find new ways to connect and we're not going to get it right. So it's part of that process, I think.
So that was The Forgotten Art of Assembly by Nicholas Berger. And Lynn, your suggestion was?
My suggestion was What I Learned When My Husband Got Sick with Coronavirus.
So those are just a couple of articles that we thought might be interesting for you to check out that we certainly found to be good reads. If you have articles that you've come across that you'd like to share with us, it doesn't have to be about the pandemic. It can be anything that's a good long read. You know, we all use more things to enrich and entertain us at this point. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or write to us at buythebook@bfm.my.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.